And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Warrior Connection on Progressive Radio Network. We're sitting here in September, I think it's September 9th of 2012, and we've got a nice sunny day here in Illinois finally. We've had a lot of rain that we needed very badly, and thanks to a lot of prayers and everything and a lot of people asking, we did get the rain that we needed, but obviously it's too late for the crops. This is September 9th. A lot of events transpiring, a lot of history and everything. And I want to go over some of the stuff that's happened and everything, and then look forward to, I'm not sure, looking forward or looking backward or thinking about what has transpired. I've invited some guests to join us this evening. If they have the opportunity, they will join us, and hopefully they will. I'm not sure if they can or not. Depends on the situation. But 41 years ago, right now, this weekend, I got off active duty in the U.S. Air Force after spending 4 years. This was during the Vietnam era. I was a bomb nav hard hat flying combat missions on B-52s, repairing and maintaining the avionics systems. I had flown my last combat mission over North Vietnam in a B-52 on about September 5th, September 6th, and then came in and got discharged, drove back, and then started college at Western Illinois University right away. So there's a lot of stuff that's happened in all these years and things that have transpired. One thing that we learned in all the years ago, 40-odd years ago for all of us Vietnam vets, Agent Orange obviously is still rampaging through the Vietnam vet era group. And has my guest joined us? Okay. As we know, Agent Orange has ripped through all the Vietnam vets. And it affects everybody. Again, this weekend I ran into some good friends that are definitely affected by Agent Orange and also got to be affected again by the horrific problems that we're dealing from Gulf War illness and everything else where the contamination was brought back to the families. One thing we need to think about as we reflect on all of this stuff, and again, looking back at Agent Orange, it's very important to realize that the Department of Veteran Affairs, the Department of Defense had full knowledge of all the serious health consequences as a result of Agent Orange. And as a consequence of this, some years ago, even though the continual denial, Admiral Elmo Zumwalt did write a report to the Secretary of Department of Veteran Affairs on the association between adverse health effects and exposure to Agent Orange. This was dated on May 5th of 1990, a long time ago. And at this time, he knew very seriously all the stuff that was there. And I'd like to just read a direct quote from this report because it all comes into play in what we're thinking about, I'm thinking about right now. Quote, after reviewing the scientific literature related to the health effects of Vietnam veterans exposed to Agent Orange, as well as other studies concerning the health hazards of civilian exposure to dioxin contaminants, I conclude that there is adequate evidence for the Secretary to reasonably conclude it is at least as likely as not that there is a relationship between exposure to Agent Orange and the following health problems: non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, chloroacne and skin disorders, lip cancer, bone cancer, soft tissue sarcoma, birth defects, skin cancer, pyrethrea, cutanea tardia, and other liver disorders, Hodgkin's, hemopoietic diseases, multiple myelomas, all the neurological defects, autoimmune diseases and disorders, leukemia, lung cancer, kidney cancer, malignant melanoma, pancreatic cancer, stomach cancer, colon cancer, nasal pharyngeal, esophageal cancers, prostate cancer, testicular cancer, liver cancer, brain cancer, and all the psychosocial effects, that's PTSD and gastrointestinal diseases. I further conclude that the Veterans Advisory Committee on Environmental Hazards has not acted with impartiality in its review and assessment of scientific evidence related to the association of adverse health effects and exposure to Agent Orange. This was from Admiral Elmo Zumwalt back in a report to Secretary of the VA in 1990. For those of you that don't have the report, you can definitely get the report by going to Beyond Treason website, or get the Beyond Treason disc that Joyce Riley and all of those we worked on so much for. That has two parts you can request. It has working with the DVD, obviously, of all of us talking and relating the experiences, and then it has all the documentation that you need. Very, very important. So if you're a Vietnam vet again, this is a piece to come in with. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up, because, again, Agent Orange is still affecting everybody. And, again, friends of mine, again, that I saw just on Friday night are horribly affected by Agent Orange. And they, unfortunately, got zapped also by all the contamination from Desert Storm. When we look at everything that's transpired over the years, we have to look at back at Vietnam. And as a young puppy myself, I enlisted in the Air Force, thought we were doing everything, and went over to Vietnam, taking the leaders and understanding and believing what the leaders had said. And the main key thing that we know today is the fact that our involvement in Vietnam was increased or stimulated by what was called the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Well, as we know today, and the history books have proven, the Nixon tapes and everything, Johnson tapes, everything have proven, the Gulf of Tonkin incident did not occur. I'm going to repeat, the Gulf of Tonkin incident did not occur. McNamara and Johnson had made that up in order to justify our involvement in Vietnam. And as a consequence, millions of casualties, I don't know, 50 or 60,000 killed in action or dying as a result of their wounds from combat actions in Vietnam. And we're looking at probably a million U.S. military alone affected by the effects of Agent Orange, would use as a defoliant over there. We do know recently, again, in the last month or so, that the U.S. has finally agreed they're going to start cleaning up some of the Agent Orange contamination at the installations where we used it over there. So that's a step in the right direction. So what we have is a history of incredible health effects as a result of military operations, incredible environmental effects as a result of military operations that don't have any justification. I'm going to repeat, the history books have now verified don't have any justification. I think one of the biggest problems we're running into, especially with the Vietnam era, and again, there's been a push on to try and justify Vietnam War and all, everybody involved it, and again, to help us come to grips with the PTSD of this stuff, by making you believe that, again, it was one thing that we had to do, and that it was justified and all this stuff happened, and again, basing on the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Unfortunately, none of this transpired. So now we have horrific health effects, and again, it comes to roost each and every day. No matter where I am, I have to deal with it myself or my friends or other individuals that come up to me where they're having the direct effects of this some 40-odd years later, compounded by the horrific health effects of Desert Storm. When we look at Desert Storm and all the stuff that happened, again, we started planning Desert Storm, putting everything together in the spring of 1990. And then as Saddam was tricked into invading Kuwait, basically in August of 1990, everything went on, and we were told him we wouldn't intervene or anything, but obviously we did to get everything in. The intelligence stuff and everything else, again, to get us into Saudi Arabia, and I worked directly on a command staff there, was that the Republican National Guard had incredible weapon systems, munitions, and armor, stuff that was going to overrun everything that we had no capability to fight against. That the Republican Guard was arrayed all the way across the Saudi border in both Kuwait and Iraq, waiting for a whole-scale invasion of this thing. Along with this stuff, the WMD, Weapons of Mass Destruction, WMD, or all, some of us call it NBCE, or somebody else call it CBR. It's all the same stuff, chemical, biological, and radiological. We absolutely knew, I'm going to repeat, absolutely knew, that Iraq had all these chemical and biological weapons. Have my guest by chance joined us? Okay. They definitely had all these chemical and biological weapons because, as we know from the Regal Commission report that James Toot wrote for the United States Senate, that the U.S. had deliberately and willfully provided Iraq with the chemical and biological weapons. Hi.
Hello.
Good evening.
Hey, that worked.
How are you? I'm glad you could join us.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Are we on the air?
I'm glad to hear. Ladies and gentlemen, my guest has joined us, and I was leading into this because as we came into it, the one thing is so important for us to understand.
Let me interrupt you, because I know you, what you want to say, but I want to interrupt you for a second.
Sure.
First of all, it's an honor and a pleasure and a privilege for me to be here to share with you a couple of minutes. I have another engagement, but I promise that I will be back next week and the following one, because there's so much to talk about. But I am... like I said, honored to be here with Doug, and I heard everything that you said about Agent Orange and about the disaster, the environmental disaster. So I want you to lead them to the disaster on 9/11, and because we can talk about the other stuff on the following interview. So we can take them a little little by little through the whole piece. How's that?
I think that'll be fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, this is one of my best friends. This is Willie Rodriguez, the hero of the World Trade Center on September 11th of 2001. Willie Rodriguez is the man with the keys to the World Trade Center, and I repeat that, the man with the master keys. After the event started transpiring, Willie Rodriguez took it upon himself without any hesitation at all to lead the rescues in the World Trade Center to bring everybody out of that World Trade Center. The other thing where Willie and I became friends, and Willie and I, and it's both an honor and disturbing to both of us, is I had the responsibility to train the New York Police and Fire Emergency Services unit that went into the tower with Willie before this all transpired, as Willie knows, and we've had to work with this. Willie, could you tell all of our listeners what happened on 911 and how you got involved and how this has affected you and so many of our police and fire, and as a consequence of military service?
Yes, on 9/11, I went into work late, and I went straight to the basement of the North Tower. And while I was there, punching my card in to start the job of the day, 14 people inside the office, my supervisor, Anthony Saltalamacchia, talking to me about the distribution of work for the day. At 8:46, we hear, boom, an explosion very loud that pushed us upwards. All the walls cracked. The false ceiling fell on top of us. The sprinkler system got activated. Water started spewing everywhere. Total mayhem. It was crazy. And total horror. At that moment, when I went to verbalize that, I thought it was a generator that blew up on the mechanical room that was located below us. There were six sub-levels of basement. And, of course, I'm just speculating because I don't know what to say, to tell what it was. And when I went to verbalize it, we hear another explosion, and then this man comes running into the office saying, explosion, 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 hands extended. All the skin was pulled from under his armpits and peeled off to the top of the fingertips. I basically, screamed of horror like everybody else, and when he turned around, he got missing pieces of his face. His name, Felipe David, a guy from Honduras that worked for a company called Aramark, which was one of the companies that supplied vending machines at the World Trade Center. And he was on the B1 level, and this is what happened to him. He tried to protect himself from the fire that was burning him inside a closet. And again, this is in 2001. You may remember that the whole campaign about people not touching anybody with blood because of the AIDS virus on 2001. So this guy was soaking wet in blood. His shirt was red because it was all, soaked in blood. So nobody wanted to touch him. So I went and I get the towels that we use for cleaning offices, and I start, basically bandaging him. And I said, don't move. I was going to call the emergency medical unit that was located on the South Tower, the North Tower and the South Tower, connected through the basement. So when I went to pick up the phone, boom, another explosion. The floor shakes so much that somehow people thought it was an earthquake. Because remember, we have no windows. We have no way to tell what's going on. We are totally unaware. And when you don't have the right information, you don't know what kind of action to take. So at that moment, everybody went running under the door frames, trying to protect themselves. And I said, no, you got to get out. We got to get out now. I started reacting because I survived the bomb of 1993. There was February 27, 1993, one of rented vans U-Haul was filled up with explosives and placed on that same building, on that same basement below us, and it blew up and killed 6 people. Over 1,000 people were injured. So, of course, I'm reacting by osmosis. I'm reliving what happened in 1993. So I said, no, we got to get out. And nobody wanted to react. Everybody was in shock. So I started pushing everybody out. I took Mr. Felipe David. I put it around my shoulder with the help of another guy that was there. And basically started leading people out when I saw that they were going to the lobby, to the area of the lobby. I said, no. They were going to take the stairwell. I said, don't take the stairwell because this is the area where this guy came from. We got to get out of here. These were workers that didn't even know what to do for the simple reason that they were temp workers. ABM, American Building Maintenance, the company that I work for, usually hired non-union workers, you know, and basically send them to do what they call bench work, and which is, you know, clean this bathroom or clean this stuff. They didn't know. They were new people. They didn't know what to do. So I basically told them, no, you got to follow me. I know the best way to get out. And I basically let them one by one, not by one by one, but the whole group, outside the building through the loading dock. When I got outside the loading dock, an ambulance came in. I stopped the ambulance with the help of everybody else, and we put Mr. Felipe David, and that's when I hear for the first time, a plane hit the building. But I couldn't discern exactly what it was coming from, so I turn around, and I see around the ambulance, there was a security guard with his radio. The radio was actually giving the transmission that a plane hit the building. And the reason that I said this is because that security guard was the one that allowed trucks to go inside the building. He's the one that checked everything, that all the trucks were for delivery, etc. And when that happened, I looked around and I see everybody on the street looking up with their mouth open. And I say, what is going on? And I turn around, and that's when I saw the whole of the impact of the plane. I saw the fire. I saw the debris falling down, and which later I found out it wasn't debris. It was people basically jumping out. And the smoke was so dense that it went up, and it covered the antenna of the North Tower. You see, the antenna of the North Tower, when you stand in the corner of a skyscraper, any skyscraper, and you look up, it gives you that illusion that it's moving, correct? And when you look at the top, you can't see the top because it's like a big triangle going up. Well, when I didn't see that because the smoke was covering it, I started screaming, the people from windows, and I meant the people from Windows of the World, which was a restaurant that was located on the 106th and 107th floor. And right away, my reaction is like, wow, you know, we got to go back. We got to go in. You know, those people are tough. And the reason I said that was because all those people in Windows of the World were my friends. I used to go every morning to eat breakfast at Windows of the World. And because I came in late that day, I was supposed to be there at 8 o'clock. Because I came in at 8:30, I didn't make it to the top of the building because I started cleaning. Oh, because I forgot to tell you, my job was a janitor. I cleaned up the floors of all the stairwells from the top of the building to the basement. So we're talking about 110 floors of a stairwell. So every morning I would go to windows, have breakfast, and start my routine going down. But of course, you know, it happens what it happened. And at that moment, I said, we got to go back. I'm desperate because my friends, I know they're trapped. And nobody wanted to go back. My supervisor told me, I remember, he said, Willie, you're not going in. You stay here. We're going to arrange the area over here. We are going to organize the people. I said, no, forget you. Actually, it was something else. And I took the radio from the security guard, and I ran back inside the building through the loading dock all the way down and straight to the South Tower. You see, remember, the North Tower and the South Tower connected. And the reason I went to the South Tower was because after the bomb of 1993, the Port Authority, the owners of the building, created something called the OCC, the Operation Control Center, which was the actual office where they managed all what it was emergencies. And basically, I went over there to let them know that I had an injured person outside. And that office was supposed to be manned and administered 24/7. When I went there and I started hitting with the radio, it was empty. Nobody was there. And there was people there before, but they ran away because they wanted to try to save their lives. But I'm there hitting and screaming, help, 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 and nobody's coming out. So, of course, what the hell is going on? Remember, I have no information inside the building, what's going on. And I turn around, and on the subgrade, from the subgrades of the South Tower, remember, the South Tower has not been hit yet by the other plane. A guy comes up named Jimmy Barrett, that was his name. I said, Willie, what's going on? And I said, Jimmy, you didn't hear what happened? And I told him, like, in a couple of seconds what just has happened. And he was totally surprised because, again, he was so low on the basement. He was probably B3, B4, that he didn't hear anything on the other tower. And I always say that gives you an indication how many people probably died on the other tower without ever knowing. So I said, we got to get out. So when I turned around between the North Tower and the South Tower, in between, there was an entrance, an employee entrance for the Marriott Hotel. There was a Marriott Hotel in the complex. And that's where the employees will go through, and they have to go through a security guard that will check their IDs and sign them in. There was a podium that they have to go through it. Well, there was a security guard there, Spanish Latino lady, trembling, shaking. And I went and said, what the heck are you doing here? What are you doing here? And you know what she said? Something that changed my life forever. She said, I heard everything, but I cannot leave. And I said, but why? She said, because I am a new employee, and I don't want to get fired. And I was, like, so angry because of that wrong sense of responsibility. But, again, it's what I always say. Remember, when you don't have the right information, you don't know how to react. So I took that lady, I took her out, and basically went back into the old tower. Again, everybody screaming, what are you doing? Don't go back. And when I go back again, I found one guy that worked for the recycling company of the World Trade Center who said, I hear screams. But there was water everywhere because of the sprinkler system. And the sound, you know, when they activate it, very loud, and you can discern where it's coming from, you know, the different sounds. So I put my ear in one of the freight elevators, the K6 car, and when I do that, what do I hear? Two people screaming, help, 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 very far away. And I got so scared, and the first thing I said is, how many of you in there? And I hear back, there's two people in here, and we're going to drown. And when they said we're going to drown, I just got totally scared. Because I couldn't understand, couldn't compute the idea that somebody was going to drown inside of an elevator. And what happened was that these two guys, one of them named Salvatore Giambanco, a worker for the Port Authority painting department. He was a painter. And a delivery guy, a guy that went to make a delivery and got involved in the worst time in American history in New York when it comes to a terrorist attack. Imagine. And they heard this explosion on the building. They went inside the elevator, and the elevator, the doors closed. Apparently somebody was calling the elevator, and the elevator, instead of going up, it started to go down. And they got stuck between the B2 level, basement number 2, and basement number 3. They could see the letters through the slit of the door. But again, the water was coming down from so many floors down the elevator shaft that it wasn't coming out at the same level as it was coming in. So the water was piling up to them. And the first thing I said at that moment was, God, please help me. And I was totally agnostic. I didn't believe in anything. And at that moment, I was just like, God, please help me. And I looked around, and I found a metal piece of a pipe in an area that was totally supposed to be clean of construction debris. I picked it up, and with the help of the other guy, we started, you know, prying the door open. We opened the door up, and because it was a freight elevator, the door did not open how you call it, vertically. It opened horizontally. And when it opened, all the water that was on my side went in with such a force flushing in. And again, I hear the scream. So I went to the border of the elevator shaft. And when I looked down, I remember it's a freight elevator. It doesn't have a roof like a regular passenger elevator. It's just a cage. And when I looked down, I see these two guys looking up with their eyes basically popping out in fear, in horror, and screaming, and water coming up to their, basically up to their bellies. And at that moment, I said, God, what do I do again? I don't know what to do. You know, I'm thinking, please help me. And I remember like a flash that in the area where the electricians, we have something called the garbage compactors for the building, where they put all the garbage and it would compress. Well, when we had the compactors in that area, there was a pillar, a cement pillar, long pillar, where the electricians tied up the ladders that they used to change light bulbs and to change electrical wires and whatever. They tied them up around this pillar with chains so nobody will steal them. And of course, I figured, well, you know, let me find one. Let me see if I can find one. And knowing very well that they were all tied up, because somebody could go with a delivery truck to make a delivery into the building and pick one of those ladders, put it in the truck, and steal it. Of course, so the first thing I said, let me find one. When I get there, dog, the incredible thing is that the longest one of all of them was not chained. Everything else was chained. And it was like it was an 18-footer, and I just basically took it, went in, dropped it into the cage, into the elevator shaft, went down, and with the help of the other guy, opened the lid, got these two guys out, and took them outside, and basically took them to an ambulance outside the building, and left them there, and went back inside the building while everybody's screaming, you know, what's wrong with you? Why are you going back? You know, you're basically trying to stop me. And I continue, and when I go that the third time, go back again to the North Tower, there's water everywhere. And the only person that I found, everything was desolated. And the only thing I found there, or the only person I found there, was a police officer for the Port Authority. He was a sergeant in charge of the K-9 unit, the dogs that smell for drugs and for explosives. They were trained by the Port Authority. And the guy that actually managed them was there asking me, Willie, do you have the key? I knew him very well. I worked at the Port Authority police desk, cleaning the desk on weekends, so I knew them all. And he reacted. I said, Willie, do you have the key? Do you have the key? He meant that I have the master key. There were 5 master keys in the World Trade Center complex at that moment. And the master keys were actually held by the building administrators, the people that were actually trained on egress, first aid, process of evacuation, disaster management, trained since 1993. And they were the ones with that responsibility, and they ran away. And, of course, I had the fifth key, and the reason that I had that fifth master key was because in 1996, while I was mopping the top floors of, like, the 90-something floor, I slipped a whole set of stairwells because I slipped on my mop, and I hurt my back. And I was basically on the floor for hours, and nobody, my company never sent anybody to look for me. I didn't have any way to get out. So I agreed later on what it was a labor dispute against the Port Authority, against the company, to basically get no money, no compensation. I didn't ask for that. I asked for a radio and for a master key in case of an emergency. And they fought so hard for me not to get it that it was almost impossible. But the funny thing is that from the 20 years that I work at the World Trade Center, the first 10 years, I worked cleaning the office of the then governor of New York, Mario Cuomo. And Mario Cuomo, to work at the office, you have to be investigated by the the state police and the NYC police to know that you're working there. So you see, that actually was my clearance, because when they say he has no clearance, all I have to do is pull out the state police ID clearance that they have from me from working at the governor's office for so long. So after I did that, I won the key, and who would have known that key was going to be so crucial on 9/11? And I said, yes, I have the key to the police officer. And he said, let's go up. We went up. We went to the lobby. And when we went to the lobby, we saw the most incredible scene that you can imagine. It was mayhem, it was drama, it was screaming everywhere, but they were my heroes, the New York Fire Department heroes, all those firemen were there with something called the Fire Access Key. The Fire Access Key is something that all the firemen in the nation have, that if they're going to a lobby of any building, they will put it into the main elevator, and the main elevator, if it's up, will go down to pick them up. If it's down, it will come up to pick them up. It will override the computer system. Guess what? They were waiting there with that fire access key. There was no elevator, because when the plane went in, cut all the wires of what they call the 58 car, and basically the car was gone. So the police officer said, don't wait for the elevator. The elevator is gone. Follow him. He knows the building very well, and he has the master key. So this group of heroes, real heroes of New York, started to go up, and it was such a sad memory that now, 11 years after, I still remember as if it was an hour ago, because it was so shocking to see these heroes with between 50, 75, 125 pounds of equipment in their backs. Some of them had what they call the oxygen guy, which is a guy with three or four tanks of oxygen to change it for the other ones. They have the guy with the jaws of life, with a heavy duty machine. All this equipment. And we are trying to go up the stairs. And as we go up the stairs, there are people coming down and bumping onto us because the stairwells were not wide enough. That was another big mistake when they built this building, of course. And as we do that, I noticed that, you know, we were having such a problem going through that stairwell that they decided to go, they told the firemen to change stairwells. We started on the B staircase to change to the S staircase. There were three stairwells at the World Trade Center, A, B, and C. And so we changed, and as we go up, with the master key, I started opening the doors, because I opened all the doors in the stairwells. The World Trade Center was considered a Class A building. On the building codification of the state of New York established that a skyscraper over 50 floors and above needs to have an encapsulation process in case of a fire, which meant that three doors or three consecutive floors, like let's say three, four, and five, fifth floor, the doors will not open on the stairwell. Will not open. And then number six will open. That will be the reentry door. Then after you reentry on that floor, three consecutive floors after that, they say seven, eight, and nine, the doors will not open. Okay? So that's why the key was so important. Now, people inside the offices, yes, they could get out. The problem was that when the building changed so much, many of the doors got jammed. And number two, because they trained the people at the World Trade Center, believe it or not, on big mistake that they had drills only twice a year, the reason that I say it's a big mistake, and it's not because of me, it has been proven by every study that has been done, was that when people were... when they did the drills, they told them that in case of a fire, everybody should gather in the middle of the floor. There's a little glass that you break, and there will give you access with an intercom to the fire safety director's desk at the lobby of the building. And he will tell you what to do. The reason they did that was because, you know, when that happened, or when there's a fire, and you break the glass, they will tell you if the fire is below you or above you. If it's below you, they will tell you to go up. And if it's above you, to go down, but not to use the elevators. And then, you know, a lot of people didn't even know where the stairwells were, believe it or not. So they are actually waiting for communication, a response back, but we forgot that the whole radio transmission for the fire safety director's desk was damaged. So they're waiting in vain for something, for instructions. And so when we go in, I started screaming to people to follow my voice, and basically direct them to the escape doors. And again, key is very important because the firemen could have broken doors, but they are steel doors. They're not, you know, regular Mickey Mouse doors here. we're talking about steel doors on every floor. So they are, the time that they will lose breaking those doors was crucial. Yeah, the idea is to get the most amount of people in the least amount of time. That's why that key was so important. And
you know,
then
Willie,
I found myself opening doors. Go ahead.
You know, one of the things, and I think as we go along, and you and I have discussed this, and what you're describing is so critical, but I want to make sure that we get this very, very, very clear to everybody, okay? There were explosions in the sub-basement with casualties before either aircraft hit the North Tower, correct?
That is correct. And again, you know, and I try to stay away from all the conspiracy theorists out there because I am a survivor. I'm a person that was there and lived through this. It could have been many things. It could have been actually a generator really blowing up. We don't know. The problem that we have from the very beginning with this was that it was never investigated. That stuff was not investigated. And again, I'm not an expert. You're an expert in intelligence and into military affairs. You can explain that later on when I leave, step by step, the process that they have to go through. But you know that my story, I got in high school interviewed by the 9/11 Commission, and my story doesn't show up anywhere on the 9/11 Commission. So they didn't want this information to be out there for whatever reason. And again, I'm not saying that it was a conspiracy because I am not an expert. I was just a janitor. I was just a person trying to save people on that day.
And you saved a lot of people.
Yes,
you saved a lot of people. I mean, you went up and down in the floors, opening the doors.
There was a moment that I found myself because, you know, I started opening doors and I continued, and that key opened the offices on the floors, most of the offices. So I found myself sometimes two or three floors above where the firemen were opening doors. And I couldn't understand. I said, wait, why are these people so slow? I just didn't get it. I didn't understand that at that time. Afterwards, I understood it. Was that I didn't have any equipment in my back holding me up, number one. Number two, they work in groups. They have a way to work that they go as a unit, and they separate, and they get together again, and they will check for fatalities, and they will put an X on a wall with a spray, and, you know, they have a way to do it. Me, I didn't have any equipment holding me up. And number two, I did the stairwells every day. So I was in better physical condition than those firemen when it came to go up and down the stairwells. You know, that was my job. I did that every day. So that's why I found myself sometimes two or three floors above them. And I remember that the craziness was then when two people came out and said, people coming down, that there was a man on a wheelchair having an asthma attack on the 27th floor. And I'm like, you know, I don't know how to help a handicapped person, and less will I know how to help them in a matter of an emergency. So I went to the fireman. I said, dude, there's a man on a wheelchair having an asthma on the 27th floor. What do we do? And I remember they said, don't worry, we'll make it there and we'll help them. But when we made it to the 27th floor and I opened that door with that key, guess what? All that unit of heroes, all my heroes, they all collapsed on the corridor one by one because they didn't have the strength, the stamina, the motivation because they were so tired already of going up so many stairs. And imagine, if anybody here have tried to go at least 20 floors up, it's very hard. Imagine that with the equipment, and imagine that with the mayhem of trying to open doors that were jammed on different floors. It was crazy. I saw these heroes on the floor. I said, oh, my God. You know, I was totally shocked. And but, you know, to recap, it was crazy. It was many explosions there, of course, and also there was the problem that there was total disorientation. The radios failed, and I tell you, the radios failed because Giuliani, who was considered a hero afterwards, was the first one as mayor of New York who cut the budget for the fire department to get lower quality radios with a transmission that didn't go through those steel frames. Imagine. And then the guy is considered a hero. We were like totally appalled by that because he was the one that gave them the budget for lower quality radios. And when the police was getting a transmission saying to abandon the building, those poor firemen never got that transmission, and I think that's criminal. And but then, you know, now to connect that, I mean, I'm going to make it shorter. I basically got to a point that I found myself going up by myself from the 27th floor up to the 39th floor, getting people out. There, you know, we heard what I believe was the impact, and I was wrong, of the South Tower, which actually was probably the collapse of the South Tower. I have no idea. I have no windows. I have no watch. I have no sense. I have a watch, but I didn't have even the time to look at it. And basically, I'm told to get the hell out of the building by the police officer. And I said no, and he asked me, he begged me to get the person that was on the wheelchair on the 27th floor. I said, you know, I'm going to get him out, but I'm coming back because I didn't want to lose the master key. And I brought that guy down with three other firemen. And as I put them on the lobby, there was destruction all over because the South Tower was already gone. And when I basically laid him down, one of the firemen said, go get the ambulance ready. Get the ambulance ready. So basically, I went to the front of the building, and the building, when I get to the revolving doors, it was everything destroyed. There was not a glass intact. It was like something big has happened on that lobby. And at that moment, when the police sees me across the street, they have the area cordoned out with that yellow tape. And when they see me, they start screaming, don't look back, don't look back, don't look back. And, of course, that's the first thing I do. I look back. And that's when I saw all the bodies of the people that jumped out of the building, people that were unrecognizable because the impact was so powerful that you only saw hair and you couldn't discern what was the body part there, a mask. You saw a mask. And I started screaming and crying. And when I lowered my face, what do I see? A lady that I helped escape, one of the last person that I helped escape from the building, I found her cut in half, the only recognizable body in front of the building. And I start screaming and crying, and all of a sudden I hear, run, run, run. And I have nowhere to run. Remember, I'm paralyzed in front of the revolving door. And the only thing in front of the building is a fire truck that is parked there, of the many fire trucks that were in the area. I basically slip right under the fire truck, and the only thing I said at that moment is, God, please don't give my mother the pain to see my body in pieces. Let her recognize my body because of what I saw seconds before, unrecognizable bodies. So at that moment, the building started basically to collapse on top of me on different areas. You could hear the whole collapse, pa, 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 and the truck basically going down. And I got buried alive. Now, how this connects directly with what you're saying, the collapse of the towers created the biggest environmental disaster ever recorded in New York and probably in the United States. When you take tens of thousands of fluorescent lights, for example, and that gas selenium that is inside, that is cancerous, and you take a fluorescent light and you read it, it says it's cancerous. If you take all the screens from the monitors, remember, we didn't have the flat screens. We had monitors, the big ones, the phosphorus. You mix that with the phosphorus of tens of thousands of computer screens blowing up. And add to that the toner from the computer fax machines and things like that. All of these environmental chemical elements getting together created such a damage that it was such a shame that they wouldn't recognize that those heroes that went there, those rescuers that went to look for the remains of our loved ones, that spent months there, they were exposed to the biggest disaster we ever knew. And you are an expert on this, and you could explain that better than I do, because I've spoken to you for years. I ask you for your expertise in many areas because of the same reason. And we have seen that more than 975 first responders died because of this exposure, and the government will not recognize them, because if they recognize a single one of them, they had like the biggest liability case in their hands. And it took years until we fought with what they call the Sadroga bill. The Sadroga bill is a bill to compensate for these people that are sick. But what do you do with people that already died, that people that were misdiagnosed, people developed cancers, asthma, sarcoma in their skin. I mean, they have developed so many different things, and people that didn't know each other. You tell me a rescuer from an island, meaning a rescuer from, let's say, from Washington that went there to work on the pile, and they got the same illnesses, and they wouldn't recognize it.
You know, one of the things that's scary about this, and both of us have a very good friend on the New York Police Department, and we'll just call him Lieutenant Bill,
yes,
who was involved, and you know who I'm referring to. And when we look at all the physiological effects, both medical problems it has and psychological effects, and I'm looking at the letter I had from him where he was just basically abandoned. And that is so frightening.
They were all abandoned.
Because
all the people that you trained from Mercy Hospital, all abandoned. All of them. They were, like, totally forgotten. And, again, you know, it was like, okay, the problem here is that you don't have insurance, or your insurance doesn't cover that. That was the biggest complaint. When you have a person that works in the force and all of a sudden don't have $150 a week to pay for medicine, that's really shameful. I mean, this is really bad. And he's asking for the government to help them after they help us so much, and everybody's just like, oh, well, you're not covered. That happened over and over and over. And it has been, like, the biggest sore. It's been so bad. And even the families of 9/11, all of them have supported these rescuers. From the very beginning, they didn't want to do anything. And now they created a compensation fund, or they reopened the federal compensation fund just to help them with the problems that we have right now, that they didn't want to recognize cancer as part of it. We fought very hard. They have changed it now. They are accepting only several types of cancer. Now, so it's a constant battle. While we are battling this, people are still dying. Remember, 10,000 people have received somehow the ill effects of this collapse.
I think the thing that's scary is what you and I encountered where we started working together so many years ago, is as we work with our police and fire friends, I mean, and you and I both lost a lot of good friends that day, and the pictures are there.
Yeah.
And it brings tears in my eyes, and you and I have hugged each other and cried together.
It's true.
Is that the health effects from 9/11 and what happened to World Trade Center, and we know at the Pentagon, are matching completely what we call Gulf War illness.
And I remember you making that connection, and I actually basically started investigating about that. And it was the same exact effect. You got the PTSD, the chronic fatigue syndrome, all of that that came from the Gulf War syndrome, we got the same thing. It was just like an extension of the Gulf War syndrome, but in New York. It was crazy.
It's so
with
frightening.
That, I have to leave you now because I have another event, but I wanted to, you know, basically come and support you. But we'll do an extended interview next time. I promise that maybe in a week or two, and we are going to continue basically exposing all the issues and problems that we had on 9/11 and after 9/11. And by that, I want to say to everybody that Doug has been, from the very beginning, at the forefront of helping us and giving us his expertise. From the very beginning, he has been a source not only of that, but of motivation, of enthusiasm to continue the fight that I do for the victims. And for that, I will be eternally grateful, Doug. And again, you know, all my love for my family to you. And please, I'll leave you with those words, but I'll be back with you in a couple of weeks.
God bless you, Willie Rodriguez. God put you on earth as an angel, and you've been an angel. You continue to be an angel. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, my friend. All the love. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have had the pleasure of having William Rodriguez explain what happened on the morning of 9/11 in the World Trade Center. He did lead the rescues. He had the master key. He's just explained to us what has transpired, and it's totally frightening when we look at all the stuff that happened. I think the most frightening thing about this, and Willie and I have worked together on this, and we'll continue on with this stuff again, the conversations, is that the explosions, the first explosions down in the basement, happened before either aircraft hit. And as I look at the photographs that Willie provided me and the police and the fire and the rescue units provided us to look at as we evaluated all this stuff, we had to think about what happened on those days and what has it led to. The horrific thing about all of this stuff is we had horrific events on September 11th of 2001. We had explosions in the World Trade Center before either aircraft hit. We had multiple explosions in the World Trade Center as the floors came down and the individuals came out. For Willie and I, for those individuals who look at this stuff and look at our friends, Life published a new book, and this was picked up last year, One Nation, American Remembers, September 11, 2001, 10 years later. And as we look at the book, you can see the rescue of Willie and the police and the fire doing the rescues in the tower as they came, you know, as they went up and down, as Willie's just described it, completely what happened on that day. It's disturbing because I have to tie everything together. And as we tie it all together, trying to understand what happened that day, both there and in the Pentagon. And again, Willie and I, I had friends in the Pentagon, and Willie has since worked with those individuals in the Pentagon also that survived. And he's been instrumental in trying to get the survivors, the military survivors within the Pentagon, their medical care. So it's very, very important to look at this stuff. Willie does have a website where you can gather additional information, where you can see some of the photographs and the stuff that we have worked with and helped us do the assessment, the analysis, to help the individual troops, the individual military personnel, again, in all the areas on this thing. But it's very disturbing to me because we have to look at it. I mean, there's a picture here that we have of the fire truck that Willie dove under where he survived, and they, you know, rescued him hours later, again, and the whole different thing. William Rodriguez, again, does have a website where you can gather additional information and understand what has happened here. And again, anything that can be done to help these individuals is extremely important. And hopefully someday in the future, all the information will come out and will ensure that everybody does get the medical care that they've earned. That is something that's so, so important. Any individuals want to get additional information on what happened with Willie that day, you can go to www.william911.com. Again, www.william911.com. That's Willie's website. I mean, he's still working, trying to take care of everything, take care of his own family, take care of all of the police and the fire and the other ones survived this horrific event on that day. But we have to come back and look and see what all did transpire. And as we look at this stuff, as a consequence of 911 events, we invaded two nations. And the invasions of those two nations has resulted in over 1 million U.S. military casualties alone, for which medical care is still delayed, denied, and ineffective. And as Willie has just related, and again from our work with the police and the fire and continued conversation with them, their medical care for the rescues that went in the World Trade Center, those that survived the World Trade Center, their medical care has been delayed, denied, and ineffective. Again, something that's not talked about. I don't think most people want to hear about it. I don't think most people want to talk about it. And we can go on from there. Again, look at this stuff, individuals yourselves, ladies and gentlemen. The military personnel, for all of us dealing with PTSD, the effects of this, we have to look at what has all transpired. Ladies and gentlemen, have a good evening. This has been Warrior Connection. We are definitely a progressive radio network moving forward. A conversation with Willie Rodriguez, a hero of the World Trade Center on September 11th of 2001. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you.